Okay, hello everyone.
Thanks for being
welcome to the Persian Circle, Salam Bahame. This time we'll be limiting our discussion to English, although you can always cheer or say Afarin or Bah Bah if I see I gave you something. It is my pleasure and privilege to introduce to you Dr. Richard Payne. He is a historian of the Iranian world in late antiquity from circa 200 to 800 CE. His research focuses primarily on the dynamics of Iranian imperialism, specifically how the Iranian or Sasanian Empire successfully integrated socially, culturally, and geographically disparate populations from Arabia to Afghanistan into enduring political networks and institutions. His current book project, A State of Mixture, Christians, Zoroastrians, and the Making of an Iranian Empire, explores the problem of religious diversity within the empire, showing how Syriac-writing Christians could create a place for themselves in a political culture not of their own making. He has published articles on the role of Zoroastrian cosmology on Iranian political thought and practice, as well as on the history of Christian communities after the Islamic conquests, among other topics. After studying at the Red Rocks Community College and the University of Colorado at Boulder, with a BA in 2004 in classics, he completed a doctorate in history at Princeton University in 2009, the fabled five-year PhD that we all dream of. He subsequently taught ancient and medieval history at the University. He taught ancient and medieval history at the Universitat Constanz, the University of Cambridge, Mount Holyoke College, and Amherst College before coming to the University of Chicago, which is this very year. For his work, Richard has been awarded the Bliss Prize from Dumbarton Oaks, the Crisp Fellowship from Phi Beta Kappa, a research fellowship from the DAAD, which I'm not, what does that stand for, actually?
Deutsche Akademische Austauschstelle.
Okay.
the German foreign, yeah, the AAD.
Okay. And a visiting research scholarship from the Institute for the Study of the Ancient World at New York University. He has also been elected a research fellow of Trinity College, University of Cambridge. Where it's a privilege to have you speak for us today, and thank you for coming, and please help me in welcoming him to our Angemeine Farsi.
Thanks. Thanks for allowing a talk in English. One of the great regrets of my career, and we can blame the five-year PhD maybe, is that I never actually learned to speak Farsi, although of course I read. This is something I'd like to rectify during my time here in Chicago. So hopefully I'll join you in the future as the kind of timid, I'll play the student role, and you all can help me improve my basic spoken Farsi. It's also an honor to be introduced by Cam. I was surprised that he left out that we went to college together and actually took a seminar together and went to high school in the same town.
Yes.
In Colorado. So there are some interesting coincidences here in the room. So let me just start. Let me introduce this by saying this is a chapter in a book that I am finishing, inshallah. I've been working on for a long time. I've sort of reorganized, and I will discuss this, and I've kind of been playing with the format of between an informal lecture, formal lecture, I'm not sure whether this is a circle or a workshop, but please feel free to interject at any point if something is less than clear. And with that, I'll begin. I assume everyone's familiar with Bisutun. Or at least has heard of it and probably knows what it looks like. If you have not, there will be several images in the course of today's talk, and you'll have a sense of its wondrous, the wonder of the site of Bisutun that so impressed ancient and medieval observers as well as modern travelers. It lies in the Zagros Mountains between Mesopotamia and the Iranian Plateau. In antiquity, this was along the so-called Royal Road that went from the imperial capital at Seleucid Ctesiphon northward toward Khorasan. Also importantly, it was a route toward Azerbaijan, which was a crucial region for both the Achaemenids and especially the Sasanians, but it's primarily the sort of axis route from Mesopotamia into Central Asia. So very likely the most traveled route in the empire, a route the Sasanian King of Kings himself would travel. And at times his summer residence was located right beneath the slopes of Bisutun. So we're dealing with a region of profound political importance in antiquity. Ancient travelers, as I mentioned, were impressed by this precipice. Al-Muqaddisi talks about the forbidding smooth, unclimbable slopes of Bisutun. The only mountain to attract his attention in such detail in his course of his travels throughout Iran. Its grandeur and antiquity was distinctly numinous. It's known as Bisutun because of the old Persian Bagastana. That's a reconstruction. That word doesn't actually survive in any text, but that's the term from which Bisutun is ultimately derived. It does appear in Middle Persian as Beistun. It features in the Bundahishan, a Zoroastrian cosmological treatise, among the great mountains that play a role in the creation of the world, as an indication of its importance within Zoroastrian thought about the shaping of the world and the ongoing cosmological struggle. This mountain is an active participant in that Zoroastrian struggle. Zoroastrian texts speak more generally about mountains as having numinous qualities. Not only having numinous qualities, but being themselves manifestations of Hwara, or the far, that we know of in later New Persian literature. The Hwara in Zoroastrian thought is something that I could dedicate an entire talk to, maybe several talks to, and still leave many unanswered questions. But suffice it to say, this is a physical manifestation of a supernatural power. That is, Hwara is something that's visible, that you can see, that's there. It's actually physically present in the world. A presence of something that is normally unseen. Ormaz is himself unseen, with a couple of exceptions in relief sculptures that don't actually get worked out in Zoroastrian thought very well. But Hwara is something you can see. There is not only the Hwara that's associated with the kings of kings, but also a Hwara of the mountains, the Hwara Igar or Kof, the Hwara of the hills and mountains, that features in several different Zoroastrian exegetical texts. For over a millennium, rulers of Iran chose this particular mountain in order to broadcast their claims to have an intimate relationship with the gods, or a god, as the case may be. This is, of course, best known in the case of Darius, who left his inscriptions, you see on the left. Apologies for the quality of the image. This is the great Bisutun inscription, one I think is probably known to all. Reliefs of the Sasanian kings of kings are located not at this eastern flank of the mountain, but at the western flank, a site called Taktibustan, where Khusra II, most famously, but also Ardashir II, Shapur II, and Shapur III had reliefs depicting their royal investiture, most likely at the hands of the god Ormazd himself, possibly Mithra in one of them. It's often debated about the identities of the deities in question. But this most sacred of Hwara-infused or suffused mountains in Iran was, by the end of the 6th century, the abode not only of Zoroastrian deities, but also of Christian saints. That is, right around the year 600, and as with many things Sasanian, we can't be much more precise with the date. We have a hagiographical text, an East Syrian saint's life, that recounts the history of martyrs who are associated with Bisutun and whose martyr shrine was located somewhere upon the mountain itself. Not only the together with a martyr shrine, we have a ceremonial, that is, Christians would visit the shrine annually. The bones of the martyrs were likely interred there. Characteristic of Christians in the Iranian world, or at least in Fars and Media, is to place those bones in an ostadan, so they're following a Zoroastrian tradition of keeping the bones out of the soil. But the text clearly describes a martyr shrine somewhere on this mountain. I'll give you a bit of the description here. This is a quote from the so-called martyrdom of Pethian Adur-Hormizd in Anahit. I'm going to shorten that for the remainder of the talk to the martyrdom of Pethian. And within the martyrdom of Pethian, there is a description of the site of the execution of the martyrs, which is also the site of their shrine. The great road of the king, which passes the foot of the mountain of the coronation of the saint and continues to many lands, as far as the outside lands of the kingdom. They're referring to Central Asia and territories that lie beyond the borders of Iran proper, that one would reach had one continued to follow the royal road past Bisutun through the plateau beyond Merv. The coronation of the saint, of course, refers to their martyrdom. The martyrs are crowned. We have here a clear description of where the royal road meets Bisutun. if you followed the royal road out of Iraq, out of Mesopotamia, past Qasr Shirin, there is really only one point in the Dinawar Valley, and the text specifies that this is in the Dinawar Valley, where the road meets a mountain. And you can see this clearly in the image on the right, because the modern road follows more or less the royal road, at least in this region, according to the excavations. So if you see that modern road, what you're looking at on the right is an image taken from the mountain itself, and you can see the modern road looking as if it runs right into the mountain. So it really goes right up to the cliff, exactly as this Syriac text describes. On the left, you can see a drawing, a topo map with the road, and see just how closely the road comes up to this part of the peak that really juts out into the valley, which is where the inscription of Darius is located, sort of high above. This is a particularly striking example of the Christian construction of holy places that is taking place everywhere from Ireland or Ethiopia into the Caucasus and even into Central Asia by the year 600. This is a pan-Mediterranean, pan-Near Eastern phenomenon. Christians are constructing saints' cults at points in the landscape, laying claim to the landscape. So in this respect, this story fits into a much larger whole. And what I want to talk about today is something more specific, that is how this sort of almost banal institution of the Christian saints cult located in a highly visible point in a landscape plays into contemporary social and political life in the Iranian Empire in the late 5th or early 6th centuries. Another aspect of this that is entirely banal is the idea of Christian appropriation of pre-Christian sacred space. Again, something we find basically everywhere we find Christians in late antiquity, and in time, we will frequently find it almost anywhere we find Muslims in late antiquity or after late antiquity. So the appropriation of sacred space is, it's quite remarkable that we have a Christian cult on Bisutun. That in itself is interesting, but what I want to look at is not simply that fact, but rather how this plays into contemporary political life. The text that I'm discussing, The Martyrdom of Petheon, is a truly remarkable piece of work. It stands out in a lot of ways in the corpus of East Syrian martyrological literature. That corpus includes upward of 60 saints' lives, 60 texts that describe martyrs who are killed at the hands of kings of kings and Zoroastrian religious authorities, or a combination of the two, from the 4th through the early 7th centuries. In this corpus of upward of 60, there are only about six that are as long as the Martyrdom of Petheon. So it's one of the longest Syriac martyrological works that we have from late antiquity, for at least from Iran. So in that respect, it's of interest. What makes it even more interesting for us is this text's knowledge of Middle Persian and its knowledge of Zoroastrianism. To give an example, when you look at, there's a recent book by Claudia Ciancaglini on Middle Persian loanwords or Iranian terminology within Syriac. The great bulk of that terminology was taken into Aramaic long before the Sasanian Empire. A great majority of the words that are actually taken into Syriac during the Sasanian period that are in that dictionary appear in this text, and there are a number of them that only appear in this text. To give a couple of concrete examples. In the domain of political terminology, the author uses the word mars instead of the Middle Persian word mars instead of the word tohma, which would be the norm in Syriac to refer to a frontier, a political frontier. Dahigan, we all know about the Dehqans, later period. This text is actually one of the earliest attestations of the word Dahigan being used to refer to a local nobility or a local aristocracy. And there are and Syriac authors contemporaneous with the author of this text tend to use an Aramaic word, barhire, the freemen, to refer to the nobility almost wherever they're writing. This text is unique in using dahigan. In the domain of religion, it gets even more interesting. This text uses very precise Middle Persian Zoroastrian ritual terminology. For example, shnuman, a ritual invocation of a god. Which appears throughout the Avesta, is used in this text. the nasc, the chapters of the Avesta, the sections of the Avesta, this word nasc is used. The word Avesta itself is used in this text. And it's one of, again, one of the earliest attestations to this word Avesta. The idea that we think of this corpus of Zoroastrian religious knowledge as an actual entity, as a whole, with a noun associated with it, is something that is actually unprecedented before this text. It appears in Syriac, Abistak. Authors sometimes used this reference to insist that there was a written Avesta in the 5th or 6th centuries. That can't be substantiated. The author thinks of the Avesta as something that's orally recited, not as something that's written. So it doesn't show us a written Avesta. But the use of the word itself really stands out here. Another example is Ahlamog, referring to, it's often translated heretic. It really means a sort of someone who makes mistakes in ritual or who is a ritual deviant. Again, also appears in this text. The text itself survives in a Middle Iranian language. On the image, not that you can make out anything anyway, but is not actually the text in question. I tried to get an example. This is just a piece of Christian Sogdian from the Turfan collection. It's very badly cataloged, so it would have taken me hours, days maybe, to actually get the exact fragment. This text survives in a Syriac manuscript from the 12th century, but also from a Sogdian version from around the year 800. These Sogdian texts are found in Turfan in Xinjiang in western China. Mm. So within 200 years of its composition, this text is being read among Sogdian writing Christians in Central Asia. That's interesting for a number of reasons. These Sogdian writing Christians are also writing or conversant with Zoroastrian ideas and are living and working in milieu that are often saturated with those ideas. So it resonates, it echoes in Iranian, in Christian communities that are writing in Iranian languages that are tuned in to some of the problems in Christian Zoroastrian interaction. So the Sogdian manuscript is really, I think, a striking testimony to this text's resonance and importance. The author not only knew the technical terminology of Zoroastrianism and Middle Iranian terms in general, but also knew a lot about Zoroastrian cosmological thought, to the extent that this text, the Martyrdom of Petheon, has been the basis for something called Zurvanism. People talk about the kind of Zurvanite problem in Zoroastrianism. They even suggest there's a separate religion called Zurvanism. This entire scholarly edifice is based on two texts, the Martyrdom of Petheon and Eznikov Kokup, an Armenian contemporary Armenian author writing in the 5th century. This text, however, gives a much more elaborate version of the Zurvan story than Eznik. This author is so clearly so knowledgeable concerning Zoroastrian cosmology and myth that the very best experts in Zoroastrianism over the past century and a half have thought him to be a more reliable witness to Zoroastrian thought in the Sasanian period than the Zoroastrians themselves. So they've preferred his view of what the normative Zoroastrian cosmogony was to that of the Middle Persian Pahlavi literature that survives in the 9th century. And we'll argue, I'm not going to go into great detail on this topic today, but I will argue, you'll see why I think this is entirely mistaken. This Christian author knows a lot about Zoroastrian thought, but he's deliberately distorting almost every aspect of it for his own purposes. But it's his knowledge here that's important. The uniqueness of this author has a social and political background. And that background is the distinctive experience of Christian communities in the Iranian highlands. By the highlands, this is a kind of neologism that I'm using instead of media, because there are a lot of cultural continuities in the Sasanian period between this region, the Dinawar Valley, and what we conventionally call Media, and Fars. That is, the geographical, some of the geography here is actually more important than the historical legacy. So I'm kind of calling this the highland region, the Iranian highlands. They're also distinct in some ways from Rey, south of Tehran, the actual plateau proper, also has its own distinct characteristics. So in this text is one of the only I say they're one of only four Syriac hagiographical works that were composed actually in the highlands, and by far the most extensive. So it really gives us, it's our main window into the social and political experience of Christians in this region. And this is important because the other Christian populations were in Mesopotamia and in Khuzestan, which are predominantly Aramaic-speaking. This is not to say there were not Middle Persian speakers and writers in these regions. They were pervasive and omnipresent. But the culture at large was mostly Aramaic-speaking, and culturally had a very different, some very different characteristics. So this is an important insight into the Iranian highlands. Also, the Christian populations of the Iranian highlands were overwhelmingly the descendants of Roman deportees. In the 3rd and 4th centuries, this is the aspect of Sasanian history that's best known, the Sasanians successfully subjugated the Roman emperors. This is the Emperor Valerian here on two different rock reliefs from the reign of Shapur I. Valerian's subjugation is merely the most visible and sort of jarring moment in a history that was full of enormous social consequences for the Iranian Empire, because the kings of kings tended to deport the populations that they conquered. So when they conquered a Roman city, and this is most notable in the case of Antioch in the 270s, they take the population back to Iran with them, and often founded new cities as settlements for these deported populations. There's lots of debate about why. It seems fairly straightforward. These populations were economically lucrative. For an empire that's really just beginning to institutionalize itself and had almost no tax base and no notion of how actually to levy a land tax on a large scale, it was convenient to create these basically mercantile communities, communities of artisanal production, and they often located them in places where trade was very easily accessible. Again, go back to the Royal Road, because we're going to see these communities along the Royal Road. They're also in Khuzestan, very near to the Persian Gulf. These communities are established in order to keep producing luxury goods. Metalworking is noted, as well as textile production, luxury textile production, gold brocade, that kind of thing. They also make mosaics. I mean, I could go on this topic. The point is, large numbers of Romans are deported in the 3rd and the 4th centuries to central Iran. Among those deported populations were some Christians, perhaps not overwhelmingly Christian, but there were some Christians. There were at least certain well-known priests and bishops who seem to have been very well positioned after the deportations to create robust Christian communities. I mean, imagine these deported groups taken from Antioch, finding themselves in Khuzestan, which, as many of you know, is just so hot, you know, and it's muggy. And, you know, if you're from Antioch, you're used to the Mediterranean, it's great. You're in Khuzestan. You're in this sort of Potemkin village that Shapur I or the II, for that matter, has created for you. The only kind of cultural axis that survives in these communities is Christianity. So whether or not the majority of the population was Christian at the time of deportation, Christianity tends to be very successful, seems to be extremely successful in these deported communities. As a result of this, by the time they start to produce texts in the 5th century, there are two terms that are basically interchangeable, Christian and captive in Syriac. And so in Syriac, it's B'nai Shebya. There are a couple of other terms that are used, but captives, basically. So Christians thought of themselves as captives. They imagined themselves as a diaspora. They did not typically linger on their Roman associations. It comes up a little bit in these texts, but very rarely. They didn't think of themselves as deported Romans. They thought of themselves as captive Christians. There are a number of unanswered questions here, one of which is to the extent to which they modeled themselves on biblical exiles and created a captive identity as a model on biblical communities. But in any case, what's important for our purposes is that they thought of themselves as captives. And this notion of being captive gets crystallized as soon as Christians start to write texts and to create saints' cults where those texts are recited. So these martyr narratives tend to be recited at the cult at the annual commemoration of the martyr, and we have descriptions of this. So these are texts that are not simply there for a literate elite or monks reading in their cells. They're actually read aloud at a martyr's feast, at which all kinds of person are expected to attend, everything from elites, sub-elites, and as well as the Christian clergy. And once these texts get written and recited, where Christians are referred to as captives, you could see how this identity as captive gets really crystallized and fixed. So Christian authors are engaged in a project of creating the idea of Christians as captives. So it's not simply that Christians think of themselves as captives and as a diaspora, but Christian authors are actually creating that and reinforcing. If that identity existed before, Christian authors are working to reinforce it. I'm going to talk about another element of Christian writing in this period. So at the same time as they're reinforcing a difference of Christians vis-a-vis the indigenous population, I'm not going to get into the legitimacy of the word indigenous. Here, when I talk about the indigenous population, I'm talking about the people in power. I probably shouldn't even mention that. This word captive is used to distinguish them from the indigenous population. That also, this author, the author of the Martyrdom of Petheon, is also trying to create a language that can be shared between Christians and Zoroastrians, between captives and indigenes. That's the project that I really want to focus on today. But before doing so, I want to talk about a little bit about why Christians might have needed to think of themselves as captives and why that might have been so successful, particularly in the Iranian highlands. And the reason for this lies in Sasanian notions of what it meant to be Iranian. Sasanians invent the idea of Iran. Iranshah is a Sasanian invention. It doesn't appear until the reign of Ardashir I. And once it appears, it's constantly remade and institutionalized in new ways. And this is something that is really, I think, the importance for the importance of the word Iran Shah for understanding Sasanian politics and society really cannot be underestimated. It's that every aspect of the political infrastructure makes sense in terms of this ideology of Iran. The rulers of the empire thought of themselves as Iranian. Now, what do I mean by Iranian? I mean Er, Middle Persian Er, the plural of which is Iran, Iran, right? So Iran Shah just means the territory or the empire of the Er, the Iranian. Now, who are these Er? Much of the contemporary literature contemporary to us, on the Sasanians, kind of works with the presumption that Iranian ethnicity was basically a kind of given. Yeah, we know who the Iranians are, whether the people from Fars and from Parthia who conquered and created an empire. And we know clearly who's an Iranian, who's not an Iranian, just like we do today, right? That's a little bit of a misrepresentation. There's more subtlety than that, but there is still a very stubborn notion in writing about pre-modern Iran that Iranianness is somehow fixed, right? And the reasons for this lie in nationalist historiography that has never been fully expunged from pre-modern Iranian history. A lot of people nod to it, but then keep using the old language. This is not a problem I'm going to solve today, but I want to alert you to it. One thing that this nationalist view of Iranianness in antiquity gets wrong is how Iranians themselves talked about what it meant to be Iranian. They thought of it as an entirely Zoroastrian idea, as an ethical idea, actually. To be Iranian was to practice Iranianness, so it had an ethical dimension. It was also to be genealogically descended from the Er, who are the primordial ancestors of the kings of kings, the first kings of the earth, and in particular the Kayanian dynasty, who are the patrons of Zoroaster, who really take up the teaching of Zoroaster and promote it and promulgate it and instantiate and institutionalize it. At least, and then here I'm talking simply about what the Sasanians thought happened. I'm not interested in whether this actually happened. These are the Iran, with whom the Sasanians identified themselves, the Sasanians and their aristocracies. So this is an entirely religious concept. Because it's an entirely religious concept, Christians cannot become Iranian. If Christians were to convert to Zoroastrianism, they could. And this is why the fixed idea of Iranian ethnicity is wrong. The reason it's wrong is that myth and those genealogies are incredibly flexible. So we see all kinds of people laying claim to a Kayanian genealogy. So it's actually a very flexible system, but well, the one boundary that is clear is a religious one. Christians can't become Iranian. They cannot claim to be heir. We have one instance of a Christian claiming to be heir, and this is in a Middle Persian inscription from Constantinople from the 9th century. It was long thought this was a Sasanian-era inscription. Actually, it's from the 9th century. So this is a Christian from Iran, an East Syrian Christian from Iran, who uses Middle Persian as his native tongue, who leaves an inscription during a visit to Constantinople, in which he calls himself an heir. So after the Islamic conquest, this language becomes, it's kind of a free-for-all. Anyone can call themselves an heir if they want to, because no one's regulating this language. It's significant, it's only after the conquest that Christians start calling themselves heir. This never happens in the Sasanian period. So if Eri, another word that's used for Iranian, this is what I'm translating as Iranianness, is this Middle Persian term, Eri. If Eri is not accessible to Christians, we have to look for what else might have been. And I want to point toward regional language, belonging to a land, in particular belonging to a land, belonging to a region. The apparent ethno-religious exclusivity of Iranianness has really given risen to the view, which is still standard in the historiography, that Christians could not achieve elite social status in pre-Islamic Iran, that they could not participate in imperial institutions, and most importantly, that they could not participate in aristocratic networks. That is, they could not engage in the aristocratic politics of the empire. East Syrian works from the 5th and 6th centuries, however, precisely this group of four martyrologies from the Iranian highlands that I mentioned, show very clearly that Christians were doing exactly that. To give one example from the 5th century, we know of a Christian so-called lord of the land, a mare datra, which is a term that tends to designate a kind of local landed aristocrat, takes possession of a number of villages, probably by buying them, straight outright purchase, renovates the irrigation infrastructure of these villages, and establishes what looks like a good old-fashioned Iranian aristocratic dastgir, an aristocratic estate. This is just to take an example from the Iranian highlands. If we expand our view and look at Mesopotamia, this kind of behavior is endemic and rife in the 5th and 6th century. Christians, whether Zoroastrians like it or not, Christians are taking on not only the attributes, but also the resources of elite aristocratic power. And the question of how they're doing this and what the implications are is the major topic of my book, and I'm only going to give one example here. In the martyrdom of Pethion itself, we have an example of a Christian aristocrat participating in aristocratic networks. The monk who is supposed to have converted from Zoroastrianism to Christianity in the middle of the 5th century, who then inspires these other saints, Anahit, Adohormist, and Pethion, to convert, is supposed to have been sent by his father, an Iranian aristocrat, who was supposed to have been celebrated at court for his knowledge of the Avesta. So a man who was known by the court for his piety, is supposed to have sent his son to a Christian foster father for his education. Now, this foster father might not sound incredibly important to us, but in the Iranian Empire, fosterage was the basic instrument for creating enduring linkages between aristocratic houses. And the aristocratic house is the basic unit of politics. Power is based in houses. These houses practiced endogamy. That is, they only marry their own. At least that's the cultural ideal, and we can often see that in practice this was in fact the case. Since they are endogamous, fosterage is the only way for them to really create enduring genealogical connections with families beyond their house. So fosterage is really, wherever you see fosterage in pre-Islamic Iranian texts, you know that's where you see aristocratic networks being formed. So the fact that we have a Christian foster father serving as the foster father for not only an Iranian aristocrat, but an Iranian aristocrat known at court for his piety, is a really remarkable piece of evidence and really suggests some of the social transformations that are happening in the Dinawar Valley in particular in the course of the 5th century. I want to show today that the East Syrian appropriation of Bisutun, the creation of this saint's cult on the slopes of Bisutun, served to facilitate Christian integration into these same aristocratic networks, into Iranian structures of power, and by which I mean really the institutions of sociability. And I'm not going to go into those in great detail for reasons of time. What is important in this text is the way in which the author reimagines the relationship between the Christian community and the landscape around an idea of the land. The land is Valashfar, that is the Huara of Valash. This is a term for the land, for the region, that really punctuates almost every paragraph of the text. The author is obsessed with this land of Valashfar. He refers to it constantly. His emphasis, his goal, seems to be to shift the locus of political belonging away from the category of Iran and Iranianness toward the category of the region, Valashfar, which is why he refers to it so often. The idea recurs throughout this text that Christians could no more belong to this land than to Iran. That is, he is responding to voices within this region that Christians could not be members of Valashfar. It was not available to them. To give a couple of examples, during the interrogation of the martyrs, the chief Mobed, who is himself from Fars, asks Adarhormiz why he's betrayed his own land, suggesting that converting to Christianity was not only a betrayal of Zoroastrianism and a betrayal of one's family and house, it was a betrayal of one's land. And he expressly instructs him, and here I quote from the text, "Do not shame our land. Do not shame the land." That is, Zoroastrianism and the land are so intertwined that to become a Christian is explicitly to shame the land. And what the text offers is a systematic rebuttal of this view. The story of Anahit, during the course of her persecution, again, of course, this is the course of her interrogation. She's being asked, why have you converted to Christianity? Why are you accepting this wicked religion? And one of her relatives makes a helpful suggestion to Anahit. Why don't you just move to another land? Move to a land where Christianity is acceptable. We do not know from the context whether the reference here is to Mesopotamia or Khuzestan, where Christian populations are better institutionalized, or to Roman territory. That seems less likely. To quote from the text, this relative asks Anahit, "Just say, I am not a Christian. I will redeem you and transfer you to one of the lands of the Christians." To this, Anahit responds, "What land or place is not full of Christ?" Meaning, every land can be a Christian land. So the suggestion that there are Christian lands, lands where Christians belong and lands where they don't, is something that this author wants to reject. Christ can be in every land, and martyrs can be every land. Martyrs who are the imitation of Christ, and really the instantiation of Christ, and the replaying of his life in early Christian thought, can be present everywhere. It's the martyrs who bring Christ to a land. That's what the author is here implying. Against those who claim the region was the exclusive property of Zoroastrians, the hagiographer argues that Christians could adopt Valashfar for themselves and even take pride in its landscapes. To take an example, we have a description here of Anahit's torment and ultimate death, which, as an example of the rich descriptions of the mountain itself and the surrounding landscape that is characteristic of the entire work. That is, whenever the author has the opportunity, he will give these very elaborate descriptions of the mountain and bring the mountain into the story. at every possible juncture. So here we have the Anahita is stretched out on the mountain. In the previous passage, it tells us that this is a sheer precipice, looking so it looks a lot like Bisutun. If we think back to that image of what the mountain actually looks like, this is a sheer precipice on which the saint is stretched out on all fours. She's smeared with honey. The importance of the honey will come back in a minute. And this is just, part of this is very standard, elaborate Christian torture narrative. Right? But he's using this standard Christian torture narrative in a culturally specific and regionally specific way to root this story in the mountain. The execution of Pethion happens in a very similar way, in a way that accentuates the mountain and puts the peak into the story at every possible moment. He is ultimately executed in the exact same place as Anahit, suggesting that the author and his audience have a precise location on Bisutun in mind. That is, they're thinking about the site of the shrine. And when you hear this text recited, it would be cited at the shrine. So these descriptions of the mountain are, you're actually on the mountain, you're staring at it while you're hearing the story about the mountain. Pethion is killed on a so-called, on a cliff beneath the desolate mountain, right? So even though he's been talking about the mountain throughout the text, he has to remind us this is a desolate mountain. And he's sort of dismembered, and his body parts are hung from different parts of the peak. That we can imagine that the reciter and the audience being able to point out and recognize. So these sort of exact points. Well, yeah, that's the rock where Pethion's right arm was hanging from. Really very specific, detailed. Characteristic. Characteristic of Christian topophilia that is nevertheless unique in this Iranian context. It's not something that we see elsewhere. We have an elaborate miracle to return to the honey. The honey is used, she's left out there, extended by all fours, left for wild animals to come after her and devour her. The melodrama of martyrology is really coming out here. Instead, what happens is a giant troop is actually the Syriac word, it's also referred to an army, of wasps comes, gathers over her body, forms sort of, it's a house-like structure over her body, stays over her body until she dies. It doesn't tell us exactly how she dies, simply starvation. The wasps don't save her. What the wasps do is prevent anyone from taking her body. Again, part of the characteristic melodrama of martyrology, the body has to be preserved. So the wasps preserve her body, and then when the priests come to take her body, the wasps part. Okay, so the wasps part, and they let her take the body. Now, once the priests leave with the body, the wasps come back. And they do something very interesting. They devour the mountain. They devour the slopes of the mountain. All of the plants, the soil, now I'll come back to the soil, let me just read directly from the text. The insects piled up in the place where the martyr had been spread out. They devoured all the earth until they reached rock, and they stayed on the mountain for 7 more days. If you imagine this in the context of Bisutun, think about this plain, this mountain that is utterly without soil or plants, right? Which is unique in the region, this sheer precipice. What this story is saying is that this mountain, sacred within a Zoroastrian framework, is actually the product of Christian miracle. That if you, the shape of the mountain itself, as it's known in to the audience of this text, was a product of the saints. That is, the wasps come and they take all the soil away to make Bisutun look the way that it does now. Right? Completely lacks any kind of historical plausibility, but we need to escape that way of thinking about this and look at how Christian communities could perceive a landscape and how perceptions of a landscape can, in fact, be shaped by text. This is something that we're seeing here. As this is celebrated year after year, the story gets sort of retold and spread and disseminated. Bisutun comes to be really the miracle of the wasps serves to turn Bisutun into a Christian icon or a Christian relic. One could say, strictly speaking, it's a very big Christian contact relic, right? A contact relic is anything that comes into contact with the body of the martyrs, bodies of the martyrs. The entire mountain in the story becomes a contact relic. To recall the original meaning of Bisutun, the place of the gods, becomes the place of the martyrs. Sacred to both Zoroastrians and Christians, albeit on different terms. The martyrs did not merely sacralize the mountain, I want to emphasize, but also established themselves as the patrons of the region of Walashvar. Again, to quote from the text, what we have here are examples of petition. It's a hagiographical or martyrological topos that at the time of the saint's death, the saint issues a petition on behalf of his or her surrounding community, or really on behalf of whomever or whatever he or she likes. And that petition then becomes characteristic of the saint's cult. So it's the continued performance of this cult that ensures that the community benefits from whatever the petition promised to bring. Right? In this case, the requests are remarkably specific. Anahit asks, "Grant, Lord, even unto this place, where we are now, prosperity, all the days of the world." Right? If you look at the language here, under this place, where we are now, you can almost hear it being recited. So you can almost see a priest reciting this text, where we are now. Mm-hmm. Pethion says, "May you receive the request and appeal of all those who call upon you in the name of my weakness." I was trying to abbreviate that, but as you are a savior and redeemer for them from all the evils in which they are ensnared, whether from evil men, hunger, wars, robbers, from corrupting animals and noxious insects, from corrupting demons and evil spirits. Preserve them, Lord, their seeds and plants. Stop the noxious insects. Drive away the noxious winds and destructive hail. The close attention that the author pays here to issues of prosperity, the land, the seeds and the plants, noxious insects, are one of the gravest threats to pre-modern agriculture, especially in the Iranian highlands, right? This is Qanat irrigation-based agriculture. It can be kind of predictable. It's not predictable in the long term, but it's predictable in the short term. Insects are not. They're entirely unpredictable. And to signal the next topic to which I'm going to turn, noxious insects are, of course, evil animals in Zoroastrianism. Evil animals that are beyond the control of Zoroastrian ritual and Zoroastrian priests. That is, Zoroastrian priests can augment the good, which can indirectly serve to cause evil to cease, but only indirectly. Noxious insects are outside. And notice here, noxious insects, this is almost precise. He doesn't use a Middle Persian word in this instance, but you could translate this literally into Middle Persian, and you have something that recurs in almost every Middle Persian treatise, Zoroastrian ritual and thought. Bisutun, as we can almost sense from this passage and its emphasis on noxious insects and on prosperity, which is another concept that could easily be Middle Persian, is still imbued with Zoroastrian significance. Christians could add meaning to the mountain. They could add their own interpretation to the mountain, but they were never in a position in Iran, unlike the Roman world, to eliminate Zoroastrian sacred sites, to erase their significance, or to suppress the performance of rituals. The Christian version of Walashvar would have to coexist with a Zoroastrian Walashvar. And a major component of the hagiographer's project was to demarcate distinct zones of ritual practice in this shared landscape. To do so, he had actively to polemicize against Zoroastrian thought and ritual, at the same time as he sought to create a place for Christians within a Zoroastrian framework for thinking about the self and society. We've already encountered an example of this in the insects, and elsewhere in the text, he's rather more explicit in naming Zoroastrian ritual as his target. He states plainly that the Avesta is a meaningless body of knowledge, that its deities were utterly powerless. To quote him, they are empty names and stones without sense. So he gets a direct polemic against the Avesta. And implicitly here and elsewhere in the text, he connects the Avesta rightly with the Yasna. And here, modern students of Zoroastrianism have something to learn from our hagiographer, in that he never distinguishes clearly between Avesta and the Yasna ritual. The Avesta, as we know it, is a text, it's something that we read in a book, but in the Sasanian period, it's something recited during the course of the performance of the Yasna. It is never separated from its ritual context, even when it is written down in the 6th or 7th century. Whenever the author refers to the Avesta, he tends also to evoke the Yasna liturgy, which I have a sort of image of a modern version of the liturgy that however much the Yasna has changed over a millennium and a half or two millennia, it still looks a lot more like Zoroastrian ritual than the stereotypes that float around about fire worship and things like that. I think it's important to have a sense of what the Yasna is actually about. I could go into more detail on this if we have time. It's here that it's in his critique of the Yasna liturgy and the Avesta that the story of Zorvan that I mentioned earlier in my talk becomes important. So the story of Zorvan is that Ormazd and Ahriman Ormazd would not create the world. Rather, Zorvan, the god of time, created both Ormazd and Ahriman. For those of you who have not heard the story before, this is kind of the gist of it. And again, as I mentioned, historians have tended to take him at his word and think that this was a view that a great number of Zoroastrians in the Sasanian period actually held and propagated, and have tried to reconstruct it in Middle Persian literature, with, to my mind, very little success. The reason he takes the Zorvan story and takes this idea of the god of time is that he wants to create confusion about the efficacy of Zoroastrian ritual. If Ormazd and Ahriman were both the creations, the good and evil deities, were both the creations of a single god, Zorvan, how can we be sure that rituals designed to propitiate the powers of Ormazd are in fact creating good? The Yasna offers, unlike a Christian ritual or many of the rituals that we're more familiar with, it actually promises the community around it real material benefits. That is, whether it's rain, whether it's crops or seeds or agricultural benefits more generally, it promises material prosperity. In fact, prosperity in a material sense is one of the words that recurs most frequently in the recitation of the Avesta and in its commentaries. There's a strong emphasis on prosperity. What the hagiographer is suggesting with this Zorvan story is that this ritual is entirely inefficacious and cannot possibly claim to exclusively propitiate Ormazd, because whenever you're propitiating Ormazd, you're actually propitiating Ahriman at the same time. So it's a polemic that is designed, I think, not to convince Zoroastrians that their rituals are inefficacious, because I don't think the argument would work for any Zoroastrian worth his salt or salt. Rather, it's intended for Christians who find the Yasna ritual appealing for a variety of reasons, perhaps largely for questions of regional prosperity. That is, the notion that the Yasna is a protective rite for the region as a whole, and this gets back to this author's connection, the creation of a kind of nexus between ritual, landscape, and prosperity, and we can see the importance of the Yasna for both Christians and Zoroastrians as a protective ritual, ensuring the welfare of the region as a whole. The author, in the petitions of Anahit and Pethion, is showing that martyrs can provide that same material welfare. We don't need the Yasna. And then he goes on, really throughout the text, to polemicize against the Yasna. So these parts fit together. Let me conclude by saying that one of the important contributions this Christian text can make, somewhat paradoxically, I think, to students or to the study of Zoroastrianism in the Sasanian period, is its emphasis on the importance of landscape to thinking about Zoroastrian thought and practice. This is a Chahar Takh in Fars, that Dietrich Huff has studied and convincingly shown that if the structure is, I don't know if you got to see the Chahar talk. I like this photo because it's such a modest structure, but it's up just on the right, that little kind of bump in the landscape, is a Chahar talk where the Yasna was likely performed. And you'll see how prominent it is within lines of sight in the region as a whole. This is interlinked with several other Chahar talks that are visible from one another. So this valley, this particular valley in Fars, as you travel through it, you almost never leave sight of a structure designed for the performance of the Yasna. So you can really see how this ritual is connected with the experience of landscape, and how the protective powers of this ritual for the material welfare of the region as a whole would be recognizable and evident to anyone who enters this particular region. The Chahar talk structure itself, as it stands now, might be early Islamic, but this is a rare example where we actually have textual evidence describing the construction of fire temples in this valley, or at least nearby. So we can plausibly say this looks a lot like what would have existed in the Sasanian period. The dating these structures is an open question to which I will yield to Professor Whitcomb. I think it's something I keep saying at talks when you attend.
Could you point out that chart top?
Yeah, so...
Where is that? I can't see.
Right here.
Oh, it's that.
Okay. Right.
It's not a tree, that.
Right.
It was a tree, right?
And there are any number of... I mean, these are you know, ubiquitous. And in... You know, the question of their dating is always problematic. But the textual evidence is really clear in linking fire temples with prominent points in the landscape, mm-hmm. which makes sense given what I talked about in terms of the Huara, the mountains, right? Mm-hmm. And creating a sense of interlinked rituals preserving the prosperity of a region. This landscape dimension and this social dimension, this political dimension, to take it to another level, is almost completely absent in discussions of the Avesta and the Yasna, and actually of Zoroastrian practice more generally in the Sasanian period. And I think this text helps us to put all those pieces back together and to see them as part of the same thing. Because a lot of scholarship does exactly what this author also does, which is to disaggregate and to create a kind of disembodied, deterritorialized view of Zoroastrianism as an arcane body of thought. Or ritual thought that only the priests had privy to and only the priests drew significance from. And I think to really get the importance of Zoroastrianism in Sasanian society and political culture, putting those pieces back together and rooting them in a landscape will be exceptionally productive. So to return to Bisutun, and this will be my concluding. We can now view the mountain as a bearer of Christian and Zoroastrian stories and symbols that played important roles in the social and political life of the Iranian Empire. The peak was a locus for belonging to a region, Walashfar, that was among the constituent parts of the empire in the realms of both administrative practice and of the political imaginary. If Christians could not become Iranian, Iran, they could become members of Walashfar. The mountain thus became the site around which the shared political loyalties of Christians and Zoroastrians could take shape. For 5th century Christians who were attaining imperial offices, wealth, and social status, belonging to a storied land, a land that earned the recognition of one's Zoroastrian peers, was a potentially indispensable asset at the aristocratic banquets at which the status of a man was measured. And here I am talking about men. The work of the hagiographer was to create an idea of Walashfar that was compatible with Christianity. The saints of Bisutun announced the development of a new kind of Christian community that could present itself in Iranian terms while at the same time setting boundary markers between Christians and Zoroastrians in the domains of thought and practice. Thank you.
Thank you very much for a very interesting lecture. Now we can open up the floor for questions.
So This was amazing. Just to venture slightly into the Islamic period, so when we think about Bisatun, there's one other really important passion that of course didn't come up in this talk because it's only attested much later, and that's Farhad. As I was reading these martyrologies, I kept thinking of Farhad carving his way into Bisatun and killing himself in the course of that. So his connection with Bisatun, I think we first have from Rudakib, so that's much later, but have you thought about that connection at all in terms of, like, again, this enduring sense of place and stories associated with the place, Bisatun?
Well, yes, I have. Not in a technical way in dealing with the narratives, but something traumatic happens in this region in the early 7th century. And that is that the King of Kings comes back. So in the 4th century, there had been a kind of surge of Sasanian interest at Taklibustan, the erection of a number of rock reliefs, and perhaps also the use of the region as a summer residence. That tends to go away in the 5th and 6th centuries. We don't really see a lot of royal activity in the region. All of a sudden, in the early 7th century, Khusra II comes back, and he comes back in a big way. The excavations suggest that his goal, his ambitions in this region were absolutely extraordinary. So if you know about Taklibustan, it's the most impressive manifestation of Sasanian art. That alone is impressive enough, but actually he intended to turn this entire region into a kind of monument to his victories over Rome. And so the cuts along the bottom of the mountain that are mythologized as having been created by Farhad, those had been there before, but there are other structures that were built that seem to have been, judging by the size of the blocks that were cut, the project would have been absolutely enormous. But it was unfinished, so we don't really know what it would have looked like, but we know that it would have been massive. Now, if we think about that, the impact of something like that, a King of Kings coming in with a massive amount of capital and trying to completely rebuild the valley, that will likely have had a significant impact on the memory, on the social experience and the remembrance of that social experience for the inhabitants of the Dinawar Valley. And surrounding regions. And so I think that's the origin for this Farhad stuff. Now, and then also the Farhad and Shirin narratives are kind of connected in interesting ways, and that's not accidental. Qasr Shirin is constructed at the same time, also by Khusra II, obviously. So, and from Qasr Shirin all the way to Bisutun, there would also have been structures, and probably a revamped royal road. The sources only allude to this somewhat indirectly, and there are only occasional references to it, so it's only from the archaeology that we have a full sense of the scale. But incidentally, the Christians thought this was a great idea, and that's only from Christian sources that actually mention this project, because Khusra II is supposed to have built a massive monastery. And I say massive because it really impressed people. They're like, wow, he actually pumped a lot of silver into the construction of this monastery. Which would have been between Qasr Shirin and Bisutun. Of course, there's a long way in between. We don't know exactly where it was constructed. But a lot of capital was invested in the region for these elaborate constructions. So I think that's probably that's what Fahad and Shirin are connected in that way.
This one you mentioned is a very interesting parallelism between Bisutun and Nakshi Rostam with the reliefs and the fortified substructures around the reliefs, the general programs for both of these holy mountains.
Right.
Whether they're focal points of the two different regions, Harsan,
right, and it's almost as if there's sort of there are these nodal points, these sort of symbolic nodal points that are, you know, experiential. I mean, even if people couldn't see, so the wall around I don't know what your view is on whether there was access to it, but it's supposed to have been this massive wall around Nakshi Rustam. I mean, you know the evidence better than anyone. What do you think that was?
Yeah. It probably was there, and it was probably fairly substantial, which meant that you had to have access to see the reliefs.
Right. And the same would have been true at Talkli Bustan, if I'm not mistaken. Right. So there, you know, even if these structures are walled in, there's still knowledge that they're there, and these, you know, the whole mountain becomes sort of symbolic, you know, resonance, sort of pregnant with meaning. And interestingly, there is a Astodan on the mountain. What is it? The Kohi Rahmat, across from Nakshi Bustan. This is something else that Dieter Huff, I think, published. There might have been someone else, where there's an Astodan with a Christian cross on it.
This is a question I would ask. Why are there no Christian symbols?
Well, I mean, first of all, I'm not sure if anyone's really looked for them. There are, so when I went a number of years ago, I did my best within the limitations that were imposed on me to kind of scramble around. There is an intelligence gathering station at the top that goes back to the Iran-Iraq War, so they wouldn't let me get too close. But I was able to scramble around a little bit, and there are a number of Astodan on the other side, up the road, about a kilometer away from Bisutun itself. There are a lot of them, actually, and it wasn't clear to me. I mean, of course, I didn't see any crosses. I wasn't expecting to, right? But I think there is work to be done. I mean, obviously there's work to be done, but there's also just survey work that could maybe find something. I think that I also wonder, why if Christians might purposefully have minimized this. I mean, they're very loud in their texts. Very loud.
Right.
But being loud in your texts and loud for your own audience and your own constituency at your one day in the year, when Bistun's only their mountain for one day out of the year. It's not as if they're building a church on it. I don't think that would have worked. I don't think that would have been allowed. There is a kind of spatial modesty that fits with their spatial ostentation, their literary spatial ostentation. So sort of the louder they're talking about the mountain, the more they might not actually have the mountain under their control. And they're making up for that discrepancy through the literature. So that would be one way of looking at it. On the other hand, we do have... I mean, so this is also a question, what do we do methodologically with one Astodan with a cross on it? I mean, that tells us that, there was like one Christian in Istakhr who had this family, buried somebody and needed a cross there. But there might have been myriad other Christians who also used Astodan, who didn't feel like they needed to put a cross on it. So, we really can't... That's very hard to work with.
I find it very hard to wrap the idea of Christians using Astodans, which suggests that the Christians are exposing their body.
Right.
Which is totally against Christian practice.
Right. Right, it is. I wonder if there are alternative ways of going about it, though. And I think in Turfan, at the Archaeological Museum in Turfan, I was there a summer ago, they had some great examples of reliquary, ossuaries, where the body seemed to have gone into. It's an ossuary, but there was a suggestion, at least, that they were ossuaries of a kind, or clay, and they're pretty big. And it's almost as if the body could have been put in there whole and then dried out over time. Which might be a way for Christians to kind of seem as if they're following the expectations. Also, so in this whole discussion about what do Christians do with their bodies and their pollution, totally ignores the entire Zoroastrian literature on Nasush and on pollution in terms of bodies. Agdain don't have pollution, because the Nasush, the demon, only attacks bodies that are Zoroastrian. You have to be fully good in your body. Sort of, it's almost as if Nasush can only hit so many bodies per day, and he gets a kind of limit, and the number of dying Zoroastrians is all he can handle. And so he doesn't. So and this is actually stated explicitly in some of the commentaries that non-Zoroastrian bodies are not polluted. So it's not as if, which you know, it's kind of remarkable to me that in that there's a lot of literature on this topic that never mentions that. It's always, and I think it's an example of the assumption that Zoroastrians are intolerant and persecutory, and because they have this emphasis on purity, and because they have this a dualist system, I'm going to bracket that for now, they must therefore be intolerant. Whereas actually they have very sophisticated ways of thinking about things and sorting out problems like this about how one should bury. And that explanation to me seems like an explanation of somewhat out of convenience or out of emerging out of actual practice, that, yeah, they've got all these Jews and Christians around who don't want to use Astodan, and so they come up with a reason. Well, yeah, Nasush can't do all of it, all the work. Yeah. Because cosmologically, and I use cosmologically instead of theologically with respect to Zoroastrianism, cosmologically, there's no good reason. I mean, this explanation for why Christian bodies, or non-Zoroastrian bodies are not polluting isn't really that well-grounded. You know, they have a little story that goes with it, but that's about it. But I think it's an example of how on-the-ground practice is kind of playing out, and the exegetes and scholars are actually responding to things that they're encountering on the ground. And one thing I'll say, just because there are a lot of graduate students present, is that the exegesis of the Avesta is just, we've only really beginning to look at this enormous corpus of Middle Persian literature. That deals with questions like this sometimes. It's not always interesting. Well, it's always interesting in one way or another, but for these kinds of issues, it's not always obvious.
So I have maybe three-stranded question, which I'll try and tie together into something that's unified and coherent. It might not. One thing involves a concept which linguists like to talk about in terms of contact zones for languages. Maybe sites of memory can be thought of, particular sites of memory can be thought of as contact zones for religions. There are mountains, oftentimes figuring these things, so Mount Basyun outside Damascus would be another place where, particularly into the Islamic period, the taking over and adding to the sanctification or the sites of sanctification on the mountain is an ongoing process until quite late. So that presumes that there are some sorts of conversations going on. Professor Wickham and I were both in a class that Michael Moroni taught here in the Moonsville on Sasanian Iran. And the question came up, for the sites, particularly the inscription sites in Iran, whether anybody was stationed there to explain for people who can't read cuneiform or Middle Persian what this place is all about. So do you have any evidence or do you imagine that these particular constituencies, let's say Christian and a Zoroastrian constituency, have places on the ground around Bisutun so that they explain to travelers going down the Royal Road or because there are pilgrims coming there? And would that discourse be, in the case of the Zoroastrians in particular, a religious discourse about the sanctity of the spot, or is it a political discourse because it's been appropriated for iconography of the kings? And then finally, how much evidence is there that Zoroastrians had particular interest or knowledge of Christian doctrine? In other words, you're documenting that there's quite a lot of interest in, well, knowledge, first of all, and an interest in spinning Zoroastrian belief in this particular martyr's text. I think in Hudud al-Alam there are indications that particular groups of Christians living in specific areas are distinguished one from another as to their belief, but can we say anything about this in the Sasanian period?
Yeah, so I'm going to take those in reverse order. Zoroastrians at this stage do not know much about Christian belief. They have a kind of maybe a basic working understanding. They start to get more through the court. So, I mean, Zoroastrians can remain more or less blissfully unaware of the Christological controversies that are happening on the ground until the mid-6th century, when West Syrians, so-called Miaphysites, start appearing at court, and they're even more loudmouthed than the East Syrians were, and start, they come with their paper doctrines and say, this is the true faith, and you have to enforce it. And the Kings of Kings say, of course, you know, what, I don't care, but they care enough to kind of, so the story is that Qabad actually takes this into his treasury, which I think is actually plausible and fits with what the late Sasanians, the intellectual interests of the late Sasanians. I think they saw this as sort of, well, this will be, well, we need to start figuring out this whole Christian doctrine thing. But they don't really do anything with it until Khusra II conquers the Roman Near East, when it becomes an urgent question. And interestingly, when he does that, and when Iranian forces enter the Roman Near East, they know exactly who to go to, and they immediately expel Chalcedonians in favor of, well, not always, but where the West Syrians are dominant, they put the West Syrians in power, so they know how to distinguish. So they're clear that knowledge is coming from somewhere, but all we can do, all we can really say is that it emerges sometime in the course of the 6th century. But in the 5th and early 6th centuries, when we see officials dealing with Christians, they don't really know what they're getting themselves into. I mean, for example, when Yazdegerd I gives a kind of sanction to the Church of the East and really establishes it and recognizes it as a legitimate institution within the empire, he is kind of shocked a couple years later to find stories of Christians destroying fire temples. He didn't know that Christians like to destroy so-called pagan shrines. He didn't know that. He didn't know anything about Christianity. He just saw it, you know, yeah, this thing is in the empire, you know, that's sort of, you know, they're struggling to make sense of and deal with them. And that's often what that story is told as one of persecution. But it can actually be told as a story of Sasanians trying to make sense of Christians. And then when the Christians get out of line, like every other subject of the empire, when you disobey the King of Kings, you're going to get killed for it. So Christians represent that as persecution. If you look at it from the other perspective, it's sort of the Sasanians trying to make sense of what's actually going on, without a lot of knowledge. But by the late sixth, seventh century, then they're very sophisticated. They know exactly what they're doing, and I think you can see this in practice on the ground. So we go from the fourth century. Shapur II goes to the Bishop of Seleucid Ctesiphon and says, "Hey, I need you to collect some taxes for me," because Zoroastrian authorities did collect taxes for the King of Kings. So he asked them to act like every other religious professional in the empire. And of course the bishop says no, and the King of Kings doesn't like being told no, and promptly kills him and every other bishop who said no. And that gets told as a story of the Great Persecution, which was actually killing, you know, a few dozen bishops and priests who said no to the King of Kings. And that sort of develops in time into the violence happens differently, but it's that sort of story. So I don't have a great answer for you there, in the sense that, and that's partly because of the evidence. We don't really have, say, anything like a royal archive or something that would really tell us exactly how much they knew. But I think in terms of their practice, you see an increasingly sophisticated interaction with the Christians that culminates in attempts to actually create a kind of compromise between different doctrinal groups. It's also very easy to exaggerate the sectarian nature or the doctrinal interests of Christians in Iran. Yes, the authors of our sources were very involved in those doctrinal conflicts and were very interested in creating different sects. And you know, on the ground, I think the vast majority of priests and bishops were not. And whenever we can see them in action, you kind of find priests and bishops who are like, Christ have one nature, two natures. Well, we know he has two natures because we've always said that. He has two natures. But you're saying he has one nature. Probably we're not that far apart. And they try to work out a compromise. And then the Catholicos writes some letters and says, you guys can't do that. You know, you're just different doctrines. And, you know, if you do that, I'm going to send somebody and, you know, you're going to lose your see, right? We actually see this happening. You know, but there is a tradition of certain doctrinal formulae, for example, the two-nature formula, that most Christians in Iran are committed to, or that they espouse when they say formulate their creed, but these distinctions aren't really that widely or commonly known or recognized until really, I think, the end of the 6th and early 7th centuries. And I think that process actually continues into the Islamic period until you're in the era of the Hudud al-Alam, when every Christian community has a label. And I think that's something that doesn't you don't really have on the ground until the 8th century.
I think it's a new phenomenon,
and I'm it's interesting if you actually juxtapose the language of doctrinal identities in Syriac with the Arabic sources. They both, around the same time that Arabic sources started saying, "Oh yeah, you've got your Jacobites, your Melkites, and your Nestorians," it's right around the same time you start seeing those terms in Syriac in the 8th century. So I think we've really exaggerated the extent to which these communities are Balkanized by doctrine in the Sasanian period, which is not to say the doctrinal divisions are not an important element. They are. But it's not as if these communities are divided and different. I have now largely forgotten the first part of your question.
So
a little embarrassed to admit.
How do you see this space around the mountain actually being shared?
Thank you. I see it as a question of time. That is, and this is based on comparative evidence with other shrines, this does tend to be a once-in-a-year event, the commemoration of the martyrs. I do not think at Bisutun that there is any physical construction on the part of the Christians. The reason that there would not have been, and probably could not have been, this is a region in which Zoroastrian authorities are pretty well positioned and anchored. Elsewhere in the empire, let's take, for example, Karka de Bitsloch, this is modern Kirkuk. The Christians can take the mountain right outside of the city and claim it for themselves and build a shrine on it and build an ever bigger shrine. And every couple decades, a bishop comes along and says, "We need a bigger shrine." And he builds a bigger shrine. And so, there's still, well, at least until World War I, there was still remnants of the shrine, the Christian shrine on the hill outside of Kirkuk. That can happen there because there are Zoroastrians and there are Iranian aristocrats settled in the region and in the city itself. But their relationship is a little more, it's the balance of power is not, I wouldn't say shifted in the favor of the Christian populations, but the Iranian elites who are settled there know that they have to work with the Christians and they have to make compromises. I don't think in the Dinawar Valley they need to make those kinds of compromise. But in all fairness, that's based largely on speculation because, or actually in the case of the shrine, whether one existed entirely on speculation because we don't have, we have the kind of preliminary excavation reports, but we don't have a kind of comprehensive study of the Dinawar Valley. Mm-hmm. So maybe there was a shrine. One thing I could say, there's no evidence for that in the text. And often these texts do talk about the physical shrine, that does get mentioned. So I think that if there had been a shrine, that would have been mentioned. It's often at the very end of these texts, they'll say, the martyrs were stored here, and so-and-so came along. Usually an up-and-coming Christian aristocrat comes along, builds a shrine, and that becomes the shrine. It's a building, typically a monastery is associated with the martyr shrine. This happens in one of the texts from south of Dinawar Valley in Masabadan, which is, we don't know exactly where this shrine was located, but it was somewhere between Khuzestan and Dinawar, so somewhere in Luristan probably. We have a very rich description of the site, and there is a story of such and such Christian aristocrat comes along, gets the martyr's bones, builds a shrine, creates a church. Then some monks come and create a monastery. I'm not sure actually if the monastery was at the same time as the church or not in that case, but there you have a discussion of the physical structure of the shrine being built. That's absent from this text, which is otherwise incredibly articulate and just voluminous in terms of the amount of material, but also it tends to add all these details, so I think that it would have been mentioned. So I think that explains the shared space question, that Christians could gain access to the mountain on occasion, once a year, It's very likely that Zoroastrians residing within striking distance of the shrine didn't even know what was going on for a while. Maybe eventually they found out what was going on when it starts to happen every year, but didn't really understand the full implications of it. One clue that a Zoroastrian audience was in mind, not an audience necessarily attending the shrine, but at least knowing that the shrine exists, is this story about the insects taking all of the dirt off the mountain. So the site where the martyrs' bodies are whether they're stored or taken, it's not left there, there's no dirt, so it can't contaminate, it can't be polluting. So there is possibly some sensitivity to the concerns Zoroastrians in the region might have about a Christian sacred site on the peak.
Yeah, please. I was curious about the Roman Deportees.
Yeah.
It's the same empire, but for the human cap.
Yes. Yes, they seem to... whenever they come up in the sources, they're connected with artisanal activity in one way or another.
Okay.
So that does seem to have been systematically the goal. They wanted the guys who knew how to weave textile with gold, who knew how to work metal, to create goods that could be commodities, profitable commodities.
Is there a narrative or documentary sources talking about the activity of the empire itself?
You mean the interaction between the kings of kings and the court and those deported populations?
Right.
Or, yeah. Yes. So actually, there's an episode, this goes back to the reign of Shapur II, supposed to have been the great persecutor of Christians. He located, not only did he found the new city, Jundishapur, and a place called Karkata Ladan, that's the Syriac term name for the city. Oh, sorry, Jundishapur is Shapur I, but Karkata Ladan, Shapur II, establishes this new city for Roman deportees. They're not far away from each other. Not only does he found this city, he locates his quote-unquote palace, that's what the Syriac text calls it, immediately next to, and again I quote from the text, a house constructed for the artisans, and in particular the head artisan, who is a Christian named Pusai. So what is this palace? We don't really know. But he was resident in Karkata Ladan. So the city that's built for Roman deportees also becomes the residence of the King of Kings, at least for a while. Again, we don't know exactly how long he resided there for. But that does suggest the importance of this relationship for him, which I think is closely related to the underdeveloped fiscal resources of the Kings of Kings in the 4th century. So they're looking to profit from commodities and mercantile activity rather than because their tax base is so inadequate. But they're also the fine mosaics at Bishapur are normally attributed to Romans. Some bridges that are built are there are connections that are made in terms of the style of the masonry. I'm not sure. I'm looking toward there's real evidence for Roman involvement. In here, it may be that they were involved in some kind of building. So if you look at the timeline, we don't know exactly when this deportee community was taken to Dinawar Valley, but as I mentioned, in the 4th century, there was a real surge of activity there. And it seems to me very plausible that they were deported to the region to help with whatever constructions were associated with the reliefs of Shapur III and the other kind of late 4th century monarchs. We know that, as Friswicka mentioned, there are normally walls around these structures, as well as other attendant buildings. So it's very likely they were brought for that purpose, because this text doesn't allude to any artisanal production of any kind. But that might be plausible, too, because of the royal road, although you're not really going to schlep a bunch of gold back and forth. Ideally, the Persian Gulf makes more sense for that, but... that they're probably there to build these structures next to the rock reliefs at Talki Bustan.
One question I have. Now, one impression I got from what you were saying is that in order to be Zoroastrian or to be Iran, to be an Iranian, you had to be Zoroastrian. These two things were, one defined the other. Now, the Christians, again, you said most of them were, descendants of the Romans who had been brought here. So what was the reason why Anahit and Pythian were being prosecuted? Because they were not, were they Zoroastrians who had converted and they were being?
Yeah.
So that's why, but so there was some conversion happening on a maybe large enough scale, and they wanted to intimidate the population. If you do that, you're going to be crucified. Was that the purpose of this kind of... that's a mark of intolerance. I mean, you say they were not intolerant, but this was an intolerant behavior.
In some ways. The intolerance issue, I'll leave to the side for now. But more or less, you're right. I mean, they're being killed for being converts. Not only for being converts, for being aristocratic converts. Converts who got attention. The only known converts from Zoroastrianism to Christianity who are, in fact, executed are elites.
Okay.
So they're highly visible. They're highly visible individuals. And so this is really a question of policing the boundary between the two. If you're going to establish the Church of the East and Christian communities as legitimate institutions in the empire and really give them royal recognition, royal patronage, and yet the empire is understood in Zoroastrian terms, all of its institutions are inextricable from the Zoroastrian religion. And I could go on that topic for a long time. You must maintain and police a very clear boundary between these two religions. And that boundary was aristocratic conversion.
All right.
So now then there's the question, did aristocratic conversion happen? Yes, there are stories.
You said some of the landlords or the nobility who were Christian who became.
Well, they're Christians who become. I put the focus in my work on Christians who become elite, who become aristocrats. The literature tends to emphasize the opposite. It tends to assume that there is this sort of groundswell of conversion to Christianity, particularly at the elite level and particularly among Zoroastrians. I don't see any evidence for that, in the sense that these are all stories like this. These are Christians writing about conversion and writing about apostasy and writing about execution for apostasy. If we add up all of the Christian accounts of conversion and apostasy, we're left with a couple of dozen people in the entire empire. So it's not a very impressive number. So this is why there are other reasons I could go into. Of course, Christians want to write about every possible episode of conversion because they want to maintain the illusion of a religion that is universally and naturally spreading. Right? So this illusion is extremely important to Christian self-understanding, this idea that eventually the whole world is going to be Christian. So they take every opportunity to compose texts that will serve that agenda and can help to maintain that illusion. And yet those texts are pretty paltry if we add them up. So I don't really see a lot of evidence for actual conversion. I think when it happens, though, when it happens and it's visible, there is a so-called law of apostasy. It's a principle within Zoroastrianism that if you convert to another religion, you are magazan. It's a sin worthy of death. We also see in practice lots of cases in the legal texts where Zoroastrian jurists, precisely the people that we would think would persecute these guys, mentioning people who've converted without any indication whatsoever that they're actually going to prosecute that. So, you know, yes, there's a principle that converts should be executed. That principle only gets invoked very rarely. But then on top of that, the number of converts seems to be very low. So that's where I get to the question. So then we ask, well, is that intolerance? Is that structural intolerance? If, 24, 40 people are executed over the course of 200 years for publicly abrogating the imperial religion, without going into the issues of whether tolerance or intolerance are appropriate terms before the nation state, which I don't think they are. But even without that, I just don't see that as actual intolerance. I mean, in the sense that what we're dealing with, I think it's more productive, put it this way, I think it's more productive to see this as the policing of a boundary, but that boundary, and then paradoxically the violence used to police the boundary, actually enables interaction. Christians and Zoroastrians can interact on an everyday level because they know what the limits are, and they know what they can ask for. And so one of the interesting things we see in East Syrian literature, even as they write about these martyrs who are apostates, they also write about one of the topoi of this literature is bishops and priests saying no to converts. And, the story of a Zoroastrian coming and saying, hey, I want to convert, and they're like, no way. And this, the story is always that they have to travel to a different region where no one knows their lineage and no one knows their background in order to convert. So it's clear that Christians also recognize this boundary and this limitation on their communities, and they see it as a basis for interaction and collaboration. So I see that as I see the violence, if and when it happened, as actually a way to facilitate interaction between Christians and Zoroastrians.
Well, it's true, but on the other hand, I mean, this is what the authorities are doing to Baha'is in Iran, right? It's similar to that. They're doing it to intimidate, to persecute. I mean, you know, it's just, anyway,
I think probably we'll have to continue the discussion.
Right, we have to, yeah. I would like to come and maybe talk about this later with you.
But it's an unfortunate duty of mine to end such an interesting talk.
Really,
but
thank you.
Unfortunately, all good things must come to an end.
Yeah.
So let's thank Professor Payne one more time.